We know for a fact that the firm of Jonathan Cape and possibly one or two more turned down Animal Farm because a Soviet spy working at the Ministry of Information said that it would be bad for intergovernmental relationships. And in fact, I came across a very amusing account given by his friend Innes Holden in 1944 of Orwell saying that, you know, my novel has been turned down on the grounds that, quote, Stalin wouldn't like it. And Orwell said, can you imagine Joe Stalin, who doesn't understand a word of any European language, sitting in his study in the Kremlin reading Animal Farm and saying, I don't like this.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, the writer and biographer DJ Taylor on the rich, complicated and too short life of one of the 20th century's greatest novelists, George Orwell. Almost 75 years after Orwell's death, we discuss why the author of 1984 matters as much, if not more, than ever.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump is sending federal immigration agents to U.S. airports starting tomorrow as the Transportation Security Administration faces staffing issues from the partial government shutdown now in its fifth week. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, is in charge of the ICE deployments to U.S. airports. On Sunday morning, Homan told CNN he doesn't have a finalized plan yet.
It's a work in progress, but we will be at the airports tomorrow helping TSA move those lines along.
Homan said he expects ICE agents to guard entries and exits at the nation's busiest airports.
I don't see an ICE agent looking at an X-ray machine because they're not trained in that.
While their goal is to help TSA move passengers through security lines, Homan said ICE will still enforce immigration laws at U.S. airports. TSA security wait times have increased as more agents call out sick or quit. Most TSA officers have worked without pay during the Department of Homeland Security shutdown. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is warning that the United States would, quote, obliterate Iran's power plants if it doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz within 48 hours. The conflict in the Middle East is entering its fourth week. NPR's Emily Fang reports Tehran continues to launch missiles in the region as U.S. and Israeli strikes hit Iran.
A spokesperson affiliated with Iran's security branches said if the U.S. targeted Iran's energy infrastructure, it would target water desalination, energy, and information infrastructure owned by the U.S. In the Gulf, Saudi Arabia said it intercepted one of three Iranian missiles fired at it overnight. The United Arab Emirates said it was responding to Iranian drones and missiles. Speaking from Saudi Arabia, where leaders from Arab and Muslim countries are meeting, Turkey's foreign minister warned the Gulf may be forced to retaliate against Iran. So far, Gulf countries have expelled Iranian diplomats, but they have not intervened militarily in the conflict. Two Iranian missiles also hit southern Israel overnight, injuring more than 120 people. Emily Fang, NPR News, Van, Turkey.
Utility crews are working to restore power in Cuba after the third major blackout this month. The power grid collapsed last night, plunging the entire island into the dark. Cellular and internet service was almost entirely unavailable in most areas. Power outages have become relatively common in recent years because of breakdowns in infrastructure. Damage across Hawaii could top $1 billion after weeks of heavy rain triggered some of the worst flooding in 20 years. Much of the state remains under a flood watch. Hawaii Public Radio's Bill Dorman reports.
Evacuation orders were lifted late Saturday for the north shore of Oahu, but were extended to parts of Maui County. Flooding alerts have also been posted for parts of Hawaii Island. Search and rescue teams have moved in where the weather has stabilized. About 200 National Guard members have been activated to help with operations.
This is NPR News. A British version of Saturday Night Live debuted on Sky TV last night. Vicky Barker reports.
Oh, golly! Well, what if Donald shouts at me?
British viewers would have instantly recognized their charisma-challenged Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, in the opening skit. Also watching, British TV reviewers, pens poised. The Times of London's verdict, quote, Britain is funny, but Saturday Night Live UK is not yet. Its reviewer wants to see more understated British humor in future installments. But the Sunday Telegraph calls the show, quote, a shockingly competent spin-off, untroubled by either annoying Americanisms or annoying Americans. And to the Observer, it didn't fail, and it could have been a lot worse. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
French voters are casting ballots today in the second and final round of municipal elections. There are more than 1,500 positions at stake in cities and towns across the country. The results will be closely watched as an indication of voter sentiment ahead of next year's presidential election. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow on mail-in ballots. The case involves Mississippi's practice of allowing a grace period for accepting ballots postmarked on Election Day, but arriving later. It was brought by allies of President Trump, who wants to bar mail-in voting altogether, except in certain cases, such as illness or serving in military. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
We know for a fact that the firm of Jonathan Cape and possibly one or two more turned down Animal Farm because a Soviet spy working at the Ministry of Information said that it would be bad for intergovernmental relationships. And in fact, I came across a very amusing account given by his friend Innes Holden in 1944 of Orwell saying that, you know, my novel has been turned down on the grounds that, quote, Stalin wouldn't like it. And Orwell said, can you imagine Joe Stalin, who doesn't understand a word of any European language, sitting in his study in the Kremlin reading Animal Farm and saying, I don't like this.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. George Orwell wrote two of the defining books of the 20th century, Animal Farm and 1984. From them, we get the terms newspeak, thought crime, big brother, and all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others, a sentiment my cat certainly subscribes to. But although Orwell left a huge imprint on our political conscience, he was far from a household name for much of his life and was lucky if his book sold a few thousand copies. What galvanized him was the Spanish Civil War, for which he took a bullet, and the rise of Hitler. In this episode of Shelf Life, the award-winning biographer, novelist and critic DJ Taylor, no slouch himself when it comes to writing novels, helps illuminate Orwell's genesis and explains why he matters as much today as ever. David, welcome to Shelf Life.
It's very good to be here.
David, most people know George Orwell as the author of Animal Farm and 1984, even if they know nothing else. He died 73 years ago at the age of 46. Why was he such an important writer? Why have those books stayed in the literary firmament, as it were?
I think there are a number of reasons. There are political reasons. There is obviously the literary quality of the books. But there are other reasons that I think in some ways pertain more to Orwell and the kind of legend, the sort of instantaneous legend that he left behind. Just to sort of particularize about that, he dies 6 months after 1984 is published, conscious that it was going to be an enormous success, but dismally aware that he wouldn't be able to participate in that success. I mean, he sat there in his hospital bed at University College Hospital, London, saying to friends, I've made a lot of money and now I'm going to die. It's fairy gold, as he once put it to a friend. The novel 1984 is extraordinarily prescient. Anything happens in the world these days, some columnists will sit down the next morning and address the question of what would George have thought about this, you know, which is a mark of that prescience, of that foreshadowing. But I think a lot of it, particularly in the 50s, when the flame caught fire, so to speak, and 1984 became a really huge seller in the early 1950s, a lot of it was to do with the legend. Malcolm Muggeridge, who's a very close friend of his, sat down in his study on the afternoon of the 26th of January, 1950, when he'd come back from Orwell's funeral on a terribly cold day in London. He read the obituaries and he said that he could see in them how the legend of a man is created. So Orwell dies, you know, 46 years old, with one of the most successful novels of the post-war era just published, with a, an extraordinarily interesting and in some ways tragic life lying behind him. I think all this sort of came together and Orwell suddenly became a figure in a way that's very unusual in the context of 20th century literature.
We'll talk about his legend more as this episode proceeds, but I want to stay with that fairy gold, the money that he earned for 1984, and that came too late. He was, as you say, stuck in a hospital bed, dying. One of the salient facts of your book is just how grim his situation often was for much of his life. The lack of money, the having to warm his hands over a naked candle, the WC at the back of his garden, the worrying about whether they would have enough to eat a lot of the time, he and his first wife. He had a very good sort of upbringing. He went to school at Eton for a while, but he really struggled for much of his life to really earn a crust. Why was that?
He did, but I think the point I would make about that is one that he made himself with his characteristically acute ear for social distinction. He defined his own upbringing as belonging to, quote, the lower upper middle class. And Orwell's definition of this, or rather, you know, explaining what that meant, was that although, you know, his great-great-grandfather was an earl, by the time Orwell was born in 1903, the money had pretty much gone. I mean, his father was a very middle-ranking colonial imperial civil servant, retired on a pension of not more than a few hundred pounds a year. Orwell went to a very fashionable preparatory school in England. He was accepted on half fees because it was thought that he might win a scholarship and do the school some credit. So he was always conscious of there not really being enough money to sustain the lifestyle that theoretically the Blair family ought to have enjoyed. He'd earned quite a lot, a couple of thousand pounds serving in Burma. But once he'd come back to England, he'd earned virtually nothing. He taught in seedy private schools. He did tutoring work. He worked in a bookshop. He scraped a living. You referred to the lavatory in the back garden, and that was when he was grinding out a living as a very, very small shopkeeper in a tiny Hertfordshire village. I think it's true to say, though, that a lot of this was willed. You know, it was Orwell making a conscious decision that, you know, it was absolutely necessary or, in fact, inevitable to live a fairly austere lifestyle while trying to become a writer. Quite almost, you know, at the margins of what I would call conventional literary life of the early 1930s. It's remarkable how isolated he is and how off the pace with what else is going on in the world of books at that time.
You mentioned his experience briefly there in Burma. He went to Eton. He would have been expected, perhaps, at that point to go to university. Instead, he joins the police force in Burma. That seems like a very unusual move for a writer so famous for his anti-imperialism, for his vehement criticism of Britain's policy in India. Why would Orwell end up going to Burma to support, in a sense, the imperial project?
You know, that's one of the great questions that always grips and beguiles Orwell biographers and Orwell scholars. He entered Eton at the age of just coming up to 14 as probably one of the cleverest teenage classical scholars in England. He was that good.
Wow.
You know, he was an exceptionally brilliant child. He won a scholarship. He was a King's Scholar at Eton. And it was confidently expected that King's Scholars would go on and be Oxford and Cambridge scholars as well. And as soon as he got to Eton, he just switched off. He did hardly any work. He idled about. And so by the time he reached 18, his options were becoming steadily more limited. And in some ways, although, as you say, you know, he became a vehement critic of British imperialism, having served it. But in some ways, for a boy of 19, with Orwell's prospects and Orwell's lack of application at school, a career in the Imperial Police Force, given his family background, was not an illogical step to take. When he applied for the Burma police, he makes the point in his application form, you know, that he has great family links with Burma, with India. It has been said by other Orwell biographers that going that 8,000 miles from Britain to Burma in 1922 was a kind of dreadful exile. But it was actually anything but. You know, he had relatives in Burma. The first 3 or 4 years he was living there, his grandmother lived there. He had an aunt living there. He used to see them socially. The idea of him being sort of flung away to the other side of the world by an uncaring family is completely exaggerating the point. There are ways in which he was actually very at home in the East. You know, exile it was not.
One of the things you set out to achieve in this book is to kind of separate Orwell from the person he imagined himself to be, the sort of personal myth of Orwell. What was the kind of person he wanted to be?
In his great novel sequence, A Dance to the Music of Time, Orwell's close friend, Anthony Pohl, says, or one of the characters says, what happens to people in life is not really important. It's what they think happens to them, or what they think that other people think. We all go through life projecting visions of ourselves, and that's what makes that life sustainable. And I feel this very strongly with Orwell. I kind of got the feeling that I could see him projecting visions of himself that were true to the idea that he had of himself, but not perhaps necessarily true to the facts and what had actually happened. This is most obvious, I think, in his days at prep school at St. Cyprian's, about which he wrote an absolutely withering 15,000-word essay condemning the headmaster and his wife on grounds of snobbery and brutality and miserable conditions and so forth. And corroborating all that is extremely difficult. And you're left at the very end of that essay, which was written, obviously, many years later. You're left with Orwell, the 13-year-old boy, leaving the school with two scholarships under his belt. He'd won a scholarship to Wellington Public School. He'd won a scholarship to Eton. He'd left the school absolutely festooned with prizes and blue ribbons and marks of approbation. And Orwell says the only thing that he took away from that school was a sense of failure. Exact dating is impossible, but my suspicion is that Orwell was working on that essay at the same time as he was working on 1984. And the atmospheres infect each other. So there are ways in which O'Brien, the chief interrogator in 1984, is like a schoolmaster. And there are ways in which the prep school in the war era is like a secret state, like a totalitarian regime in the way that everybody is eavesdropped on and spied upon. So all this is very interesting. And it's light years beyond the experience of the average schoolboy at the average English prep school during the Great War.
Yeah, as you say in the book, the theme in common with both this essay, which is titled Such Were the Joys, and 1984, is this sense of constant surveillance. But I'm also interested in that sense in which Orwell felt a failure, because it does seem to be a theme throughout his career. You say at one point that he was his own worst enemy. He was always sort of damning his own books before they were published, criticizing his own work. He seemed to have what today we might call imposter syndrome for a lot of his life.
You're right. It's more than self-deprecation. I mean, there are people who are modest about their achievements, about their writing. And then there is Orwell, who was convinced, even when he wrote 1984, he was writing to his publisher saying, it was a good idea, but I've mucked it up. And in some of his earlier novels, The Clergyman's Daughter, certainly he refused to have reprinted in his lifetime. When he was writing it, he kept on assuring people that it was useless. Most writers are not like that. Most writers assume that their work has a kind of trajectory. And I do find this odd about Orwell, because you see, the interesting thing about those early novels, there are four novels written between 1934 and 1939, and they're realistic and they're entirely different in terms of background and sort of geographical setting to the dystopias to 1984 and Animal Farm. But in terms of plot, they're all exactly the same book. They're all about rebellions that fail. They're all about ground down solitaries oppressed by malign exterior forces, trying a tiny rebellion and then failing. So it surprises me that he repudiated some of that early stuff, because he was obviously developing some of the techniques and developing some of the atmospherics. I mean, all the characters in those early novels are being spied upon in some way. They're always fearful of being eavesdropped and gossiped about and having people talk about them. So the seeds of this, I suppose you could almost call it paranoid obsession with being interfered with, are evident very, very early on in his work.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the biographer and novelist DJ Taylor. His latest book is Orwell, A New Life. David, we were just talking there about Orwell essentially disowning his first novel, or his first novel published in the UK, A Clergyman's Daughter. That was the first Orwell novel you read, I think, at the age of 13. How did you come to know his work?
I came to him rather obliquely because large numbers of English syllabi for teenagers, I think both in America and in the UK, feature Animal Farm and feature 1984. And I can remember, I forget how old I was, but I can remember picking up a copy of Animal Farm in an English classroom and seeing the words "A Fairy Story" written, you know, to the subtitle, and thinking, oh God, what's that? But at home, my parents were not particularly bookish people, but my mother had a shelf of paperbacks that she'd acquired in the 1950s and 60s. And there was, I think, a 1961 Penguin edition of A Clergyman's Daughter, which I simply picked off the shelf and started reading when I was about 12 or 13. The experiences described in it were pretty remote from the experiences that I'd so far gone through in my short life. But the immediacy of the style got me. You know, I've said this countless times, but it's worth saying that Orwell wrote a famous essay about Henry Miller, the American writer whose novel Tropic of Cancer he very much admired. And Orwell said that what he felt when he read this book for the first time was that he wrote it for me. Miller knows about me. He's written this specially for me. It's as if there were just one copy in the world and it were mine. You know, it's a bullet shot across time by the writer and it's hit me. And that's what I felt about Clergyman's Daughter. I felt this is, I've not read prose in my life that connected to me so much, that made me want to read more of it, that made me want to think about the author, and that made me want to think about some of the themes and the issues he was writing about. I then read a lot of the early, some of it quite minor journalism. There was an original four-volume collected journalism and essays and letters, which I used to buy volumes of at the local university bookshop. And then I read Keep the Asp District Flying, which is about this fantastically embittered, disaffected poet called Gordon Comstock. You know, and there are marvellous scenes when he opens a rejection letter from a magazine called the Primrose Quarterly. He's so end of tether about it. He's so furious. And yet, for some reason, women seem to find him attractive. And I identified with this. I wonder how many, you know, aspiring writers have wanted to be Gordon Comstock. Perhaps not very many, but I certainly did at the age of 15, 16.
I'm also a fan of Keep the Asp District Flying. It's not a book that probably sells in any great quantity today. And I often wondered when I was reading your Orwell, A New Life, whether Orwell would have had any recognition today or even be in print today had he died in the Spanish Civil War or had he died of tuberculosis earlier than he did.
That's a very interesting question. And I would have to say that it really was Animal Farm in 1984 that cemented his reputation. He very nearly died in 1938. He had the first of his really bad hemorrhages and was spent some time in a sanatorium. And I think if he had died then, posterity would probably regard him as an interesting and very promising 30s writer whose life had been cut short. And there might perhaps be a couple of his novels in print.
Orwell resigns from service in Burma after a number of years and returns to England. His parents are not happy. I think you write that it takes a few years for that relationship to recover. Why did he decide to return to Britain and what did he do next?
And here, I think another aspect of the Orwell myth probably kicks in because it's very seductive, this idea of the 24-year-old throwing over a safe job because he can't stand serving the Raj anymore, coming home, beginning a new life. I don't think it was as simple as that because he didn't resign. He came home on a medical certificate. He'd had dengue fever, which is a tick-borne viral infection. He'd been very unwell. And he didn't make the decision to resign from the Burma police until some time after he'd come back, when he'd announced to his parents that he was going to be a writer. And there was huge sort of astonishment and dissatisfaction from this very conventional family. So I think he was obviously dissatisfied with his life there, but I think it took some time for his feelings to gel. There's also the fact, one of the things I discovered in researching the book is that he came back from Burma in 1927 with an engagement ring, which he proposed to bestow upon his childhood sweetheart, Jacintha Buddicombe. Little did he know that she just had an illegitimate baby by somebody else, and she wouldn't see him. Rejected all his overtures, and he was furious. But speculatively, if he'd asked Jacintha to marry him, and she'd said yes in 1927, what would he have done? How would he have supported them? And my conclusion about this was that if he'd asked this young woman to marry him and she said yes, they would have gone back to Burma because there's nothing else to do. no other way of earning a living. And so in some ways, Jacintha not marrying him was her bestowing perhaps the greatest gift at her command on him. But having done that, having decided that he wanted to be a writer, he went about it in the most laborious and painstaking way. He spent time in Paris. He researches among the down and outs. That was the background to down and out in Paris and London. He earned a subsistence living for several years. And it wasn't until the start of 1933 that he published his first book. So it took him essentially 5.5 years from returning to England to actually making some kind of success as a writer.
And one of the things that holds him back is his dislike of literary cliques, of his sense of being an outsider, of his inability to network or utilize former friends from places like Eton or his prep school. He really is the sort of epitome of the solitary writer at his typewriter in this, you know, wind-blown coastal town, Southwold. But he is a furious writer. I mean, he's turning out stuff. You quote a friend of his saying, he didn't mind what he wrote at all, he just wrote.
No, you're right. There's a tremendous sense of solitary determination there. The friend to whom you're referring, a friend who's called Dennis Collings, who was around in Southwold at the time, remember that Orwell sort of thought that he could achieve things simply through perseverance. And he didn't really care what he wrote as long as he wrote, you know, that there was something tangible at the end of the day. Had he made an effort, he could have got himself connected to some of those circles in which, you know, careers take root and prosper. But it was his decision not to. And in fact, Keep the Astrodiscus Flying is full of very scarifying remarks about snooty young men who glide from Cambridge to the pages of the literary reviews. And clearly, Orwell was resentful about the fact that he hadn't gone through that career path himself, that he was back from the Burma police at the age of 24 with no connections worth speaking of.
I would be remiss here, David, not to mention one of your early books, A Vain Conceit, British Fiction in the 1980s. It was itself quite critical of literary cliques. Did you have some kind of fellow feeling with Orwell's outsiderness yourself at the beginning of your writing career?
I did, but comparisons are invidious, and they're especially invidious to me, because I think, had he been able to inspect my early career, would have immediately marked me down as one of those snooty young men. But in fact, back in the 1980s, it was quite difficult to establish any kind of a foothold in literary life because, you know, magazines and newspapers were still being run by people who liked employing friends that they'd walked around Cambridge colleges with in the 1950s. And it was sometimes very difficult. And looking back at my younger self, I'm actually sort of rather ashamed of my arrogance. But it's always been difficult. I mean, it's always been difficult to establish yourself in literary life. It's far more difficult now than it used to be then. And I have huge sympathy with anybody in their 20s and 30s trying to make a living out of it.
One of the distinguishing sort of hallmarks of Orwell's writing and his personality was, of course, his antipathy to London, to city life. He loved the countryside. He loved nature. Nature is something that crops up again and again in his work, in his essays, in his novels. Does this make him a particularly English writer, despite his global renown?
It certainly draws him into a tradition of writing about England, of writing about, you know, life outside. But the point about Orwell's absorption in the natural world, which, as you say, is a constant throughout his life, even when on Jura, the very end of his life, you know, he's zealously recording details of birds he's seen and rats he's caught in the byre and toads that he's seen hopping along. But the important thing about it is it has an underlying political point. So, for example, in his fourth novel, Coming Up for Air, the hero, George Bowling, is a fisherman. And there is a passage in which Bowling reflects, and he goes through the names of the English coarse fish. And he goes, perch, tench, roach, dace. They're quiet sort of names. You know, the people who invented them hadn't heard of concentration camps. So fishing is much more than a pastime for Orwell. It's something you can set against the malign exterior forces that are trying to control the world.
I think you can see some of that same kind of underpinning in his essay, Some Thoughts on the Common Toad. We have an excerpt for the show read by the actor Tilda Swinton. Let's hear it.
Before the swallow, before the daffodil, and not much later than the snowdrop, the common toad salutes the coming of spring after his own fashion, which is to emerge from a hole in the ground where he has lain buried since the previous autumn, and crawl as rapidly as possible towards the nearest suitable patch of water. Something, some kind of shudder in the earth, or perhaps merely a rise of a few degrees in the temperature, has told him that it is time to wake up. Though a few toads appear to sleep the clock round, and miss out a year from time to time. At this period, after his long fast, the toad has a very spiritual look, like a strict Anglo-Catholic towards the end of Lent. His movements are languid but purposeful. His body is shrunken, and by contrast, his eyes look abnormally large. This allows one to notice what one might not at another time, that a toad has about the most beautiful eye of any living creature. It is like gold. For a few days after getting into the water, the toad concentrates on building up his strength by eating small insects. Presently, he is swollen to his normal size again, and then he goes through a phase of intense sexiness. All he knows, at least if he is a male toad, is that he wants to get his arms around something, and if you offer him a stick or even your finger, he will cling to it with surprising strength and take a long time to discover that it is not a female toad. Frequently, one comes upon shapeless masses of 10 or 20 toads rolling over and over in the water, one clinging to another without distinction of sex. By degrees, however, they sort themselves out into couples. After a day or two, the spawn is laid in long strings which wind themselves in and out of the reeds and soon become invisible. I mentioned the spawning of the toads because it is one of the phenomena of spring which most deeply appeal to me, and because the toad, unlike the skylark and the primrose, has never had much of a boost from poets. But I am aware that many people do not like reptiles or amphibians, and I'm not suggesting that in order to enjoy the spring, you have to take an interest in toads. There are also the crocus, the missel thrush, the cuckoo, the blackthorn, etc. The point is that the pleasures of spring are available to everybody and cost nothing. Even in the most sordid street, the coming of spring will register itself by some sign or other. If it is only a brighter blue between the chimney pots or the vivid green of an elder sprouting on a blitzed site. Indeed, it's remarkable how nature goes on existing unofficially, as it were, in the very heart of London. I've seen a kestrel flying over the Deptford Gasworks, and I've heard a first-rate performance by a blackbird in the Euston Road. As for spring, not even the narrow and gloomy streets round the Bank of England are quite able to exclude it. It comes seeping in everywhere, like one of those new poison gases which pass through all filters. The spring is commonly referred to as a miracle, and during the past 5 or 6 years, this worn-out figure of speech has taken on a new lease of life. After the sort of winters we have had to endure recently, the spring does seem miraculous because it's become gradually harder and harder to believe that it is actually going to happen. Every February since 1940, I have found myself thinking that this time winter is going to be permanent. But Persephone, like the toads, always rises from the dead at about the same moment. Suddenly, towards the end of March, the miracle happens, and the decaying slum in which I live is transfigured. Down in the square, the sooty privets have turned bright green. The leaves are thickening on the chestnut trees. The daffodils are out, the wallflowers are budding. The policeman's tunic looks positively a pleasant shade of blue. Is it wicked to take a pleasure in spring and other seasonal changes? To put it more precisely, is it politically reprehensible while we're all groaning, or at any rate ought to be groaning under the shackles of the capitalist system, to point out that life is frequently more worth living because of a blackbird's song, a yellow elm tree in October, or some other natural phenomenon which does not cost money and does not have what the editors of left-wing newspapers call a class angle? At any rate, spring is here, even in London, N1. And they can't stop you enjoying it. This is a satisfying reflection. How many a time have I stood watching the toads mating, or a pair of hares having a boxing match in the young corn, and thought of all the important persons who would stop me enjoying this if they could. But luckily, they can't. So long as you are not actually ill, hungry, frightened, or immured in a prison or a holiday camp, spring is still spring. The atom bombs are piling up in the factories, the police are prowling through the cities, the lies are streaming from the loudspeakers, but the earth is still going around the sun, and neither the dictators nor the bureaucrats, deeply as they disapprove of the process, are able to prevent it.
That was Tilda Swinton reading from Some Thoughts on the Common Toad, one of George Orwell's many essays. My guest for this episode of Shelf Life is Orwell's biographer, DJ Taylor. David, Orwell was prolific. He seemed to have been writing almost constantly when he came back from the Spanish Civil War for one magazine or literary journal or another, many of them with very small circulations, so perhaps only read by a few thousand people. Can you describe that kind of journalistic journey for Orwell? How does he develop at that point?
He develops in a very interesting way to me, because he begins as a kind of all-purpose reviewer, writing reviews of any book that comes his way and trying to find something interesting to say about them. Towards the end of the 1930s, beginning of the 1940s, and especially when he's taken on to write for his old friend Cyril Connolly's monthly magazine, Horizon, which is one of the great publications of the Second World War, it's then that he starts taking up a position in what I would call the world of literary sociology, I suppose. And one of the earliest marker flags on this path is his essay, Boys' Weeklies, which he wrote for Connolly in 1940. And it's about the school stories of the Magnet, the Gem, and Billy Bunter.
Right. These are stories that would have been very common, familiar to schoolboys of Orwell's generation, though perhaps not familiar to many people today.
No, but absolutely then. And so he then decodes their sociological and their political underpinning in a very amusing and astute way. There's another wonderful essay called The Decline of the English Murder, where he examines how murder cases seem to him to change in the last 100 years of British life. And he really was carving out a new field here in literary journalism. And I think it's not exaggerating to say that in England, and to a certain extent in America, he is the godfather of what we would now call cultural studies. The idea that there are some topics where you can bring politics and sociology and books together and find something to say about human life in general that will be of great interest to the general reader rather than to the specialist. That, to me, is his really pioneering aspect as a journalist in the 1940s.
You're listening to Shelf Life with a special episode on the life and work of George Orwell with his biographer, DJ Taylor. We'll be back after this.
There are some fine singers and songwriters, fine musicians and bands too, that although successful, are not always thought of as highly appreciated as much as they deserve. So next time on The Why I Learn Among Kids with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, I bring you not exactly the undiscovered, but the underappreciated, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Donald Trump's threats against Cuba and the desperate situation of Cuba's people.
On the one hand, the Cubans are looking at Iran and they're thinking, the Americans are in this quagmire. This benefits us. On the other hand, they're thinking, we've got to get some energy supplies. So they're going to go into this like a canny poker player.
Reporter John Lee Anderson, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen tonight at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with DJ Taylor, the author of Orwell, A New Life. David, Orwell met his first wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, at a party at his home in London when he was living there, and knew that same night that he wanted to marry her. They end up having a pretty small wedding, not too long after, really, just 9 people. And almost immediately after that, of course, he returns to writing. How would you describe this marriage and their relationship?
It's very difficult to get the hang of. It's very easy to say that he neglected her, that he was entirely self-centered, that he was very self-serving, that it was simply his career that mattered and not hers. And they were strong-minded friends of Eileen's who couldn't understand why she'd done it and thrown aside a career. You know, she was studying for a master's degree in psychology at the time, and they couldn't understand why she'd done it. I think the key to their relationship was actually Eileen's letters, and they are extraordinary performances. Trying to decode them, I don't know that you ever could, because they're whimsical, they're funny. You know what she feels about Orwell. You know that she's critical of him, but you know that she worships him at the same time. She's also very astute. There's a marvellous description of, I think, New Year's Eve, 1938, with Orwell's taken all the candles, you know, and has gone into the other room and then comes in at midnight to ask, you know, oh, there's their coffee and biscuits, I'm hungry, and the dog's just been sick. And it's so redolent, I think, of their life together. At the same time, too, she's very astute about the way his mind worked. I mean, here is a radical socialist in the 1940s from a very conventional background, a small C conservative in everything but politics. And so when he's writing his famous essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, about, you know, the shape of post-war England, about only a socialist nation can fight effectively, so we have to be a socialist nation to defeat Hitler. And it's a very radical document. It's far more left-wing than anything that the British Labour Party was advocating at the time. And Eileen's comment on this, which is just wonderful, she summarises this 40-page pamphlet. She said, George is writing a pamphlet on how to be a socialist while Tory. And that's it. And that encapsulates the difficulties that he had, the going against the grain of his nature that his left-wing affiliations produce. But the letters that she wrote just before she died on the operating table in 1945, when Orwell is in occupied Europe, being a war correspondent, are extraordinarily self-deprecating. And there's one where she actually worries about how much money the operation is costing and whether she is worth it. And it's so sort of self-abnegating that you really worry about her, you know, the way in which she's almost kind of disappearing from her own life. I mean, Orwell certainly, again, you know, there's very little that he ever said about her, other than when she died, he remarked that she wasn't a bad old stick, which was his, you know, immensely conventional way of trying to deal with this. But he obviously, he loved her very deeply. And I think he felt extremely guilty when she died that he hadn't looked after her better. You could certainly make out a case for Orwell, the great neglecter of a talented and mercurial woman who could have had a career. But did she want a career? She worshipped him. And in fact, in Spain, when there are, you know, suggestions that Eileen was carrying on with Orwell's company commander, all the people in the Independent Labour Party office where she worked, all of them just said, you know, you could never get us to stop talking about Orwell. So everybody was tremendously well-informed about what Orwell was doing because Eileen just went on and on about him all the time.
You mentioned Spain. This was a galvanizing moment for George Orwell, but also for her. Eileen follows him out there. He leaves for the front December 1936, not 6 weeks after their marriage. There's a picture in your book of the two of them surrounded by fighters. He gets a bullet in the throat, but amazingly survives. You say that if the two had remained in Spain, it's very likely that he and Eileen would have been shot.
It's not exaggeration. When they escaped and ended up in Perpignan in July 1937, they found their names on a list. And the reason was that by the time Orwell got back to Barcelona, you know, when he recovered from the bullet wound, this was at a time when undesirable elements were being combed out of the left-wing opposition to Franco by what were, you know, Spanish Republican government authorities, but basically under the control of Soviet commissars. So yes, you know, he was down at the sharp end. Orwell had tried to go to Spain under the auspices of the British Communist Party and join the International Brigade. But the communist people in London were suspicious of him, thinking that he wasn't politically orthodox. So he went to Spain under the auspices of the Independent Labour Party and joined a kind of anarchist Trotskyist anti-Stalinist militia group, the POUM. And this was always going to lead to problems. And all these chickens came home to roost halfway through 1937 when he got back to Barcelona. And there were friends of him who spent time in jail and never came out of it. So there were a great many casualties not on the battlefield in that struggle. And Orwell was very nearly one himself.
And you write that this is the moment that Orwell really becomes a political writer. His subsequent book, Homage to Catalonia, is turned down by his own publisher. He struggles to find an audience when it does get published. It's sort of hard to imagine now that the publishing industry at that time or at any time could be so enthralled to Stalin, as it was then.
You're quite right. I mean, Victor Gallant's Orwell's publisher, the Left Book Club, which published The Road to Wigan Pier, was pretty, as far as we can deduce, pretty much, not if not under communist control, then very much influenced by what the Communist Party of Great Britain was saying at its offices in King Street. And this continued into the 1940s. I mean, 5-6 years later, Orwell had terrible trouble getting Animal Farm published, because this is an obvious criticism of our gallant allies, the Soviet Union, at a crucial time in the Second World War, you know, as the Second Front is beginning. And we know for a fact that the firm of Jonathan Cape and possibly one or two more turned down the manuscript of Animal Farm because a Soviet spy working at the Ministry of Information said that it would be bad for intergovernmental relationship. So Animal Farm is finished in the spring of 1944. But it's not published until the late summer of 1945, simply because so many London publishers are just too scared to publish it.
And for the listener who may not be familiar with Animal Farm, can you sum it up in a nutshell, the story?
Animal Farm is a satire of the Soviet Revolution, a meticulous satire, with a group of animals on an English farm in the south of England who decide to rebel and take over the premises and expel Farmer Jones. But the notion of equality on which all this is predicated is soon overthrown by the pigs, who end up taking control and basically exerting their will over the other animals, and gradually, incrementally diluting the principles on which the revolution is founded and all the commandments by which, you know, equality and freedom are supposed to be promulgated, eventually reduce themselves to a single slogan, which you quoted early on in this program, which is, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. And in the end, there's a rapprochement between the pigs as the rulers of Animal Farm and their human neighbors. And there's a terrible moment where the animals peek into the drawing room where the pigs are playing cards with the rival farmers. And they look from man to pig and pig to man, and it's impossible to tell which is which. And that's Orwell's final comment on the betrayal of the principles of the Soviet Revolution by its subsequent rulers.
It's an incredible book, in part because it is so tightly written. But it's also a riposte, I think, to those who argue that Orwell didn't have a sense of humour. It's funny.
Oh, Orwell had a terrific sense of humour. Burmese Days, his first novel, though it ends tragically. I mean, everything ends in dereliction and despair and decay, but it's actually quite funny. Orwell is very funny about the Burmese potentate, U Po Khin, the local magnate who is scheming to his own advantage. There's some savage humour in Keep the Asperdistra Flying. Coming Up for Air is very funny, you know, seen through the perspective of a fat 45-year-old middle-aged man. Though he had a terrific sense of humour. It just gets disguised. There's this legend of Gloomy George, as the art critic Michael Ayrton called him. And there was a sense in which he was sort of unhappy and alone and miserable. But there are times when he had a pen in front of him where he could be very, very amusing and funny.
I'm Aaron Hicklin, and this is Shelf Life. I'm talking with the biographer DJ Taylor, who's just written his second biography of George Orwell, Orwell, A New Life. David, you mentioned early on in this episode that new material had come to light, which prompted you to write a new biography of Orwell, Orwell, The New Life. Can you tell us a little about that material?
It was very exciting because it turned into a real biographer's quest. The great part of his life that is mysterious to me and to previous biographers was that sort of post-Burma pre-marriage stretch. It's his life in Suffolk in the early 1930s, where he's staying a lot of the time with his parents. And we know that he had relationships with two women, Brenda Salkeld and Eleanor Jakes. And I'd known for years that there was this cache of letters to Eleanor that had never previously been published. They'd emerged in the most extraordinarily dramatic circumstances. They literally were clearing the house, her daughter's house in Southwold, and there in the woodshed, stuck inside an old bag with mouse droppings over it that somebody was about to throw away, out fell a buff envelope with the words, "Burn after my death," written on it.
Wow.
Inside were 19 letters from Orwell to Eleanor from the early 30s. And so eventually, sort of like, almost 10 years later, they came up for sale. And Richard Blair, Orwell's adopted son, in a fantastically philanthropic gesture, bought them and gave me first dibs before he gave them to the Orwell Archive. But then it got even more sort of biographically wonderful, because I was speaking at a festival in North Norfolk where these letters were being displayed just as Richard Blair was negotiating to buy them. So I'm talking about Eleanor and the significance of this woman in Orwell's life. And as I got to the end of my speech and asked for questions, a little old lady bobbed her head up and said, "This is all very interesting, but what about Brenda?" So I said, "Well, yeah, Brenda, fascinating figure. Absolutely. Wish I knew more about her, but I'm talking about Eleanor here." To which the little old lady said, "Well, I'm her niece." And then she said, "And I've got all her letters." Now, some of the Brenda letters were already in print that we knew about, but her niece turned out to have a whole load more, which were quite fascinating and showed the depths of Orwell's obsession with Brenda, who had never wanted to marry him. Eleanor didn't want to marry him either. But the sequence went on, way on to the 1940s. And it showed to me that once Orwell had got a woman into his system, he was never able to get her out. Mm. And so Brenda, for example, is visiting him in hospital in 1949. Brenda's coming to stay with him on Jura. He keeps up with Eleanor. And in fact, Eleanor married his best friend in Southwold. It was a real sort of Jules et Jim relationship. But the first thing he did almost when he came back from Spain was to write this immensely detailed letter to Eleanor, which in some ways sets out his view of, the Spanish situation just as interestingly as Homage to Catalonia does. So there were those two big caches of letters. And then the other thing I was determined to do is the Orwell survivors. And I sat down not long ago with Richard Blair, his adopted son, and we tried to calculate how many people there are left in the world with coherent memories of Orwell 73 years later. And we worked out that it was 7 or possibly 8.
Wow.
And I was very, very fortunate in that I managed to turn up one or two people who sort of disappeared from the edge of the map, whose connection with Orwell had not been known. You know, they'd known him when they were smaller. The youngest person left alive who knew Orwell is Richard Blair, who's 79. But there are people who remembered him as children in the late 1940s who had very, very interesting things to say. And I even discovered here in Norwich, which is not a very sort of populous part of Great Britain, I discovered an old gentleman of 93 living only a few miles away from me who'd known Orwell in Southwold in the 1930s.
Wow.
Last week in London, we had a launch party for the book, and I was able to say that of the 8 people that's still alive who knew Orwell, 2 of them are in this room. It's an absolutely extraordinary experience.
Biographer's gold there, courtesy of my guest, DJ Taylor. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. David, you mentioned that this recent cache of letters that were discovered, 19, written on the envelope, was burned after my death. There could, of course, be more material hiding out there. Among the facts that made me sit up in your new biography of Orwell is that 2 volumes of his diaries were purloined by the NKVD. These are the Soviet sort of security forces when he was in Spain, and very likely exist in a vault somewhere in Moscow.
Well, we hope that they do. There's a marvelous Orwell scholar called Marcia Karp, who's just written a book called Orwell and Russia. And the difficulty here is that there is certainly this archive that's been closed off to the general public. And it's certainly run by ex-KGB people. And the general consensus among Orwell Russian experts seems to be that although we have a list of the items that they took, only one of those items, the text of only one of them, has ever been made available from the Comintern archives. And there is a strong possibility, I'm afraid, that they don't exist anymore, got lost in the system and disappeared. So although we have a list of things that were stolen from Orwell, as you say, in Barcelona in 1937, there is no concrete proof that they're still there.
Hmm.
We really should talk about the genesis of 1984. When did the idea first suggest itself to George Orwell?
The genesis of 1984 is fascinating because of all Orwell's books, it's the one that took him the longest to write. He was a very prolific, fertile writer, usually wrote a novel in a year. I know Animal Farm is only 30,000 words. He wrote that in 3 months. He got the idea for 1984 at the Tehran conference late in 1943, when Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin sat down and effectively divided up the post-war world. But then it takes him almost another 5.5 years to get this novel into print. Part of the reason, obviously, is his personal circumstances, the tragedy of his wife's death, the adoption of Richard, his declining health, his move to Jura after the Second World War. But I think it's also that it took a long time for him to work out the intellectual armature of the book, by which I mean that you can see through the period 1944 to 1947, he's writing a series of essays that kind of foreshadows some of the themes of 1984. And so I think it took him quite a lot of time to get ready to write it. And then when he began writing it, he then became ill. He'd written quite a bit of it by the end of 1947, when he has to go and spend time in a sanatorium to recover his health. And then at the end of 1948, he's in a tremendous rush to finish it because he knows that his health is declining. And so he's sitting there in the early winter of 1948, chain-smoking away over a defective paraffin heater in this drafty bedroom on the Isle of Jura, finishes writing the book, and then virtually collapses and is taken away and spends the rest of his life, the last year of his life, in bed until he dies. So I think that's why its genesis takes quite so long compared to the earlier
books. And as you say in your biography, the reception to 1984 is pretty instant. I mean, it never really dwindles in the sort of public space after that. Why is it that Orwell still has such a hold on the public imagination today?
Well, I think he had the ability, a very rare ability amongst writers. Shakespeare had it, Dickens had it. And what he had was an ability to worm his way into the consciousness, into the mental atmosphere of people who might not have heard of him or read his books. He once himself said of Dickens that it would be possible for a comedian to go on stage and imitate a character in one of Dickens's novels and be recognized by people who perhaps hadn't read the novels. And in the same way, phrases like Big Brother is watching you or Room 101 or the All Animals Are Equal are now in the popular consciousness, in the kind of general mental atmosphere, without necessarily people associating them with Orwell. That's a true mark, I think, of his ability to transcend some of the limitations of the average book and its reception by people. You know, it's like people who quote Shakespeare without realizing that they're quoting Shakespeare.
Yeah, you mention at the beginning of your biography that in 2021, when the European Court of Human Rights was ruling that the British spy agency's interception of online communication was illegal, three of those judges invoked a passage from 1984. The passage is, there was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given time. We're always referencing Orwell when it comes to sort of the global politics of today and the rise of the surveillance state. I wondered myself frequently after reading about his journey to Spain, which you say was driven by compassion, whether Orwell today would be in Kyiv, you know, in Ukraine.
Unfortunately, all speculation is profitless. He's 73 years dead, in just the same way that, you know, people sometimes say, oh, if Dickens were alive today, he'd be writing scripts for Succession or whatever. But Dickens was a 19th century novelist. Orwell was an early 20th century novelist and journalist and polemical writer. There are plenty of friends of his prepared to say that he would actually become quite right-wing and conservative in his old age. But I like to think, obviously, that he would have been able to take a view on some of the international situations that confound us at the moment.
It's almost possible that his early death may have saved his reputation.
I think
posterity.
That's a very good point. A very good point.
David, thank you so much for being a guest on Shelf Life.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I've been talking with DJ Taylor about his biography, Orwell, A New Life, published by Pegasus Books. And you can see DJ at this year's Deepwater Festival on Friday, June 16th at 7 p.m. at the Tustin Theatre in Narrowsburg, and again on Sunday, 18th of June at Delaware Hall in the Narrowsburg Union, when he'll be joined over a live link with George Orwell's son, Richard Blair. More information can be found at deepwaterfestival.com. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, there are plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Ari Shapiro, Lydia Millett, Joyce Maynard, and Alan Cumming. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star review? It can help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
We shall live in peace.
Shortly before Pete Seeger died, Matt Wetrova promised him he would continue community sing-alongs.
The truth is that I have never found anything that connects people in quite the same way that singing together does.
We will hear from Matt, and I'll be playing songs that are sing-alongs. That's on the next Folk Plus, Sunday at 2, here on Radio Catskill.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.